Welcome everyone to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is Over Before You Know It, How to Diagnose Response Time Spikes and Kicks. Today's presenters are Daniel Zachary and Nicholas Mingo. Dan Zachary has been on the KICS Level 2 support team since 1989. That experience has afforded him a deep understanding of KICS internals in many areas. His current favorite areas of KICS are kernel, dispatcher, monitoring, and the language interfaces. Nick Mingo has been with the KICS Level 2 support since graduating from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte in 2008. During his time with KICS, he has been involved with in-depth problem determination, co-author of a Red Book, and a co-inventor of multiple patents. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Dan. Dan, you may begin.
Thanks, David, and thank you all for joining this morning. So I am Dan Zachary.
And I am Nick Bingle.
And together we'll take you through this presentation. So let's get started and go to slide 2, please, David. All right, so the agenda is, first thing, what's the problem? Next, we'll talk a little bit about system events and how to use it to externalize max text, max task conditions, or near max task. A little dispatcher basics, a little on the monitoring facility in CICS, RMF3 for rookies, just a couple of areas of RMF3 that will help us on problems like these. SysTrace perf data, that's an IPCS command that we will use to make use of a dump to give us LPAR level information. And then problem solved, we'll talk about a lab problem that we're going to do during this presentation. Okay, so let's go on to slide number 3. And so what is the problem? So for this presentation, we're going to use a lab that we did and created here. And this is sort of a little blow-by-blow of the problem. Message number 1, you can see there at 7.10.08, it says above 60% of max task. But prior to that time, everything was fine on my test region, IYNXK, and then suddenly, without me knowing why, it started going above to max task, 60% of max task, and then 80. And then on the right-hand page at the end, you can see it all ended about 3 minutes later at 7.13.11, where we went below 50% of max task for the last time. So in there, in the beginning, you can see there's a dump taken at 7.10.14, 7.10.17, and that's a slip dump. So we'll talk about how you can automatically trigger a dump when you start approaching max task. And like I said, all of the documentation that we're going to look at here, some RMF3 data, some SMF110s, a dump, we'll look at this very slip dump. It's all from this one recreate that these messages sort of give you the timeline of. Okay, so let's go on to slide number 4, please, David.
So from here, a new feature that's being offered in KICS Transaction Server 4.2 are system events. These system events are business-type events that result from system activity. System events can include such things as resource state changes, thresholds being crossed, and unusual system actions. We've used the KICS Explorer to build this event binding file. Along with this, we've also prepared and installed the transactions and programs that will write out these various console messages that were described on the previous slide. Lastly, we will demonstrate how to slip on this to capture a system dump utilizing these new messages that we've created with the slip. Slide 5, please. Now, we have not included the whole steps to get you to this point for this event binding, but this is the specification section, and this is where you will specify your actual messages. As you can see from the left-hand column, we have the above 60s, the above 80s, the above 100s. This is our naming convention, and you can use whatever you would like for this. Slide 6, please. Now here is your capture point, and this is the point where you need to specify the system capture point, such as a file enable status, file open status, or in this case, we've used task threshold, and we've associated it with the above 80%, and you'll be able to use that for any of those messages or specifications. Slide 7. Continuing on, the next tab will be the filtering tab. This is where you'll specify event options. And for this, review the, again, the above 80, which you need to clarify that goes higher than 80%. You can also do this for the other ones. They have other values in that field. Slide 8, please. This is the adapter tab, and from this tab is where the event will be emitted for this binding file. You can see the adapter here that we've used as the custom written user adapter. Now, there are other adapters that you can put in there, but we've used this one. And this is a KIX program that you will write to provide a combination of formatting and routing of an event that is not supported by the supplied adapters. The other thing that you will need to specify here is the transaction ID, and this is the one that we've used is EPTT. Also, if you can take note, at the bottom of the screen, there's also the advanced options. I will describe that on slide 9, please. From here, we've pretty much kept everything as a default. The only thing that we've changed is the dispatch priority to high. Slide 10. Now, here's our custom program that we've created. It's a relatively simple program, but KIX offers quite a few different containers for this event. And the one container that we've used is the DFH EP context. Now, this contains context data for the event your adapter is processing. Along with this container, we've also included the execkix write, which will generate the messages to the console. Slide 11, please. Now, here are the last few steps that need to be done. You need to export this bundle project, which contains your newly created specifications. You need to define and install these transactions, or the transaction definition for, in our case, the EPTT, or whatever transaction you've decided to use. Along with that, you need to use your program to define the program definition and also set the transaction to a priority of 255. Next, you will need to also define and install this bundle. And lastly, here's the actual slip that we use to capture the system dump with the message ID of above 80. Now, of course, we could put whatever we wanted to for that message ID as long as it correlated to our new specification messages. Slide 12, please.
Okay, great. Hey, so one thing I wanted to tell you folks is you might want to remember a slide number in case there's a slide you have a question about. Coming up is going to be some graph-type slides, and if you'll just make a note of any slide you have a question about, then we can refer to it later in the presentation. And also, I want to say that this lab that we're doing, you know, the lab documentation that we're going to be using as a basis for the presentation, you know, it's specific to what it is, and all of these problems are different. And so I certainly am going to point out areas where, you know, that will apply more generally to problems such as these and not just specifically on the one that we recreated for the lab. Okay, so next thing is some dispatcher basics. So let's go to slide 13, please. Okay, so across the bottom is a little graph, and this is the perspective of one processor on the LPAR. And if you just look at that for now, you can see that one thing happens at a time. A green bar represents somebody using that processor. And so I have four dispatchable units of work in the LPAR, a couple of KIX regions, TCBs, and some unnamed SRB and TCB. So you can see that they, one at a time, share the processor. And it's the ZOS dispatcher that decides, you know, who runs, decides to take control away from one thing and give it to the other thing. All right, let's go on to slide 14, please. Okay, and there's several different ways that a dispatchable unit of work, such as a TCB or an SRB, can lose control. It can do it on purpose, you know. It chooses to relinquish control, and control could also be taken away from it. Let's go to slide 15, please. All right, so one way is a TCB can be interrupted while it is just minding its own business, executing instructions. ZOS can interrupt and give control of the processor to a higher priority TCB or SRB. And when that happens, the interrupted TCV is, as I say, left high and dry until later when it is given the processor again, and it can then resume executing instructions. All right, let's go to slide 16. And then this states that a TCB can voluntarily give up control. CHS does that when there are no tasks, no CHS transactions ready to run on say, the QRTCB, and then the KIX dispatcher would give up control with an FCC1 wait. All right, let's go to slide 17, please. And another way is paging. You know, if you're running along executing instructions and you need a page of storage that has been referenced, that has been paged out, sometimes it has to be paged in from aux storage, and that requires some I.O. And, of course, during that time, you don't have control of the processor, and other TCBs and SRBs could be using the processor. So that's another way that you can lose control of the processor. Okay, let's go to slide 18, please. Now, a typical well-behaved quasi-rent CSS application program doesn't do anything that would cause the TCB to wait other than through the CSS dispatcher. So, all right, so what we're going to do next is we're going to concentrate on the KIX1 QRTCB. So that's the top line in my graph below. So we're going to show what is going on during the green bars of the KIX1 QRTCB. From the ZOS perspective, it's just executing instructions in KIX, in this TCB. But in the CHS world, you'll see that a lot's going on during the green bars for CSS1 QRTCB. Okay, so let's go on to slide 19. Okay. So in the world of this one QRTCB in KIX1, there's a little piece of code that I'm calling here the dispatcher, the QRTCB dispatcher, and it decides who runs on this QRTCB. And in my graph here, I have four transactions that are all that I'm saying are all started here at about the same time, at time zero on the scale. And that red shading means they're dispatchable. They're all ready to run on the QRTCB. Of course, just one thing can run at a time on this QRTCB, and it's the dispatcher that decides. So let's go on to slide 20, and we'll see that the dispatcher chose transaction 10,001. Okay, the other three, they're continuing to be dispatchable, ready to run, but they have to wait their turn. Now, I want to say, so that green bar, that transaction 10,001, that represents the time that he owned the QRTCB, the time that he was in control of the QRTCB. So that looks like that's seven of my units of time. And during that dispatch, I would call that a dispatch. It lasted seven units of time. During that dispatch, it used some CPU. If it executed instructions continually, owned the processor for that whole 7 units of wall clock time, then it will be using 7 units of CPU. Typically, during a dispatch, on average anyway, transactions don't use the whole wall clock time of dispatch time. They don't execute instructions all that time. It's some percentage of the dispatch time. Okay, so let's continue on with slide 21. And we'll watch the dispatcher choose another task, this time 10,002. And there, on 10,002's green bar, that's what I am using to represent how it wasn't actually executing instructions during that life section in the middle of it. So that, in fact, is where the processor was taken away and given to some other dispatchable unit of work on the LPAR. Okay? But from the KIX dispatcher's perspective, we just know it had control past 10,002, it had control of the QRTCB from time slot 9 to 22, and then the KIX dispatcher does learn at the end from ZOS how much CPU time during that wall clock time that task used. Okay, so let's go on to slide 22, and a little bit more of the same, transaction 10,003 ran. After that, you can see that the dispatcher, the green bar at the bottom, that it itself was interrupted. So these ZOS interrupts can happen really at any time. And here I'm showing it happens during the CSS dispatcher. So not during any transaction, but during the CSS dispatcher. That's probably pretty rare. But in fact, all my green bars for the dispatcher are probably overly big compared to the other ones. It would be a tiny piece, really. Okay. I haven't talked much about suspend time, but the green bars are dispatch time. The red ones are suspend time. And so if we take a look at transaction 10,001, you see that he got control originally, and then he suspended on something, maybe some file I.O. And then his red bar is white in there, and that represents time really waiting on, say, that file I.O. It was, waiting for a millisecond or two, for the actual file I.O. But then at time spot 25, you see that red bar becomes shaded in with the pink. And that means that that's at the moment it became dispatchable. So that's the moment where the I.O. completed. And then immediately that transaction is dispatchable. So it's still, from one perspective, waiting on the file I.O., but the last piece of waiting is the piece of getting redispatched. And so that's what I'm trying to show with the red shading like that. Okay, so where we sit now, you can see the Kix dispatcher still has about three transactions dispatchable, and he's going to pick one and carry on. So let's go to slide 23. And I've fast-forwarded a bit, so the same old thing's going on. One at a time, transactions are sharing this QRTCB under the control of the CSS dispatcher. I want to point out here that tasks 10,001 and 10,002, they're finished. Those transactions ended, and they gave control to the Kix dispatcher that way. So we just have transactions 10,003 and 4 left. And you can see that both of those are not dispatchable. So if they're waiting on file I.O., that file I.O. hasn't come home. And so when the Kix dispatcher decides, well, who to give control to, well, there's nobody ready to go to get control now. And so this is the case where the Kix dispatcher would do an SVC 1 wait and give up control voluntarily to the ZOS, to the LPAR, to the processor. Okay, so let's carry on to slide 24. And you can see here, during that wait, those two transactions, their I.O. came home. And so they became immediately dispatchable. The Kix QRTCB, though, didn't wake up immediately. It would. I'm sure its ECB is posted, and it can wake up. But probably no processor is available. Other dispatchable units of work in the LPAR are running. And so this period of time delays ticks a little bit until it finally wakes up at time unit 79 and now has two more tasks to choose from to dispatch. So let's go on to slide 25, and I believe I finished those two out, and then those four transactions are finally done here about 95 units of time from where we started. Okay, so let's go to slide 26, and I'm going to sort of replay this with both perspectives so that you can see them at the same time. And so there's the first little bit you can see for Kix 1 QRTCB, where while he was in control for 11 units, you can see what he did. And then it all stops, and something else ran on the LPAR, on this particular processor. This is all from the perspective of one processor, as if the LPAR had just one processor. Okay, so let's go to slide 27. Okay, and so you can see how it works here. So when the TCB loses the processor, it's like everything freezes, although, of course, time moves relentlessly on. In effect, it's a little bit like fits and starts. So the processing on one Kix region's QRTCB sort of goes like that. And so let's carry on then with slide 28. So more of the same. Here's the one where our Kix 1 QRTCB voluntarily gave up control because no transactions were ready. And so you can see, even when those transactions become ready, with shown by that red shading, somebody else is using the processor. The Kix 2 QRTCB is. Okay, so let's carry on to slide 29. and more of the same. And then let's go on to slide 30, and we finish up. Okay, very good. So let's go on to slide 31. All right. So we're not going to leave these transactions that we just went through. We're going to use those to help illustrate CSS monitoring information. Okay? So let's go on to slide 32. So just briefly, this is these sort of define the two KICKPA forms that we're going to use to talk about mostly today. One of them is called SUSSUM. That's the one that the name is in red. And it's mostly fields having to do with times when the tasks are suspended. A transaction is always either suspended or it's dispatched. It's either red or it's green. And so I've divided the monitoring information into those categories as well with these two forms. Okay, so let's go to slide 33. All right, so these are our four transactions all sort of laid out, like you know. And on the bottom is these KICKPA forms, the way they would look on a KICKPA report. And we're going to sort of fill out those forms slowly so we can learn more in detail about what each of the categories are. Okay, so the red one is the SUSSUM and the green one is the DIFFSUM. Okay, let's go on to slide 34, please. Okay, so a part of suspense time is the wait for first dispatch, and it's a discrete part of suspend time, and that's what we're going to talk about first. So when you average all those wait for first dispatches, the bar is that what you see for average there, and so that's what I've put into the SUSSUM area for average DISP1 delay, where it's highlighted there, so that's the 19 units. There. So the average for those four transactions is the 19 units. That's waiting for first dispatch. Okay, let's go to slide 35. Okay. Now we're putting aside the rest of suspend time. I think I have these slides out of order, actually. So when you're not suspended, you're dispatched, and these green bars represent dispatch time. And I want to say in my example and in the lab, it's all on the QRTCB. So we don't use any other TCB, and it makes it more simple. And I just want to make that point. Okay, so here there's several things to keep track of. So if you add up all those green bars and divide them by four, you get the average. And as well, for that portion of the dispatch, average dispatch, that portion that's using CPU, then that's displayed there with the solid green versus the light green. And then if you added up all those green bars and just totaled them, then you would get that total. And as well, a portion of that total is actually using CPU. Okay, so on the bottom disk sum chart, I fill those things in. The average dispatch time, which is the whole green bar, is 15. Average CPU is 11 units. Where I was actually using CPU. And then since this is all on the QRTCB, you have the same number for average QR disk time and average QR CPU time. And then I give that one total column, the total QR disk time, is often very useful. And so it's just the total of those four transactions rather than the average. Okay, so let's go on to slide 36. And one aside here, so by the total QR disk time of those four transactions, you might say that, oh, okay, so four can run in 60 of those units. Well, yes and no. There's also the time of that the KICS dispatcher itself used the TCB. So if you added those on there, it takes more like 80 of those units, where the QRTCB is solidly in use. So, and like I said, the QR dispatch time is probably bigger than would be the case, but it is there. So like if these four transactions, if I had four arriving every 80 units, then I'd be okay. The QRTCB can get four of them done in 80 units, So as long as the arrival rate is about 4 per 80 units, then I'm good. If I get like 8 every 80 units, then you can see they can't all have their time on the QRTCB, and so they'll start to back up. Okay, so let's go on to slide 37, please. All right, this is the rest of suspend time. So there's the wait for first dispatch part of suspend time, and then there's the rest. There's no real name for this rest of suspend time. So what I want to point out here is of that rest of the suspend time, a portion of it is when you're waiting for redispatch, and that's indicated by the red shading. So filling out our form here, I've got the average DISP wait. That's the overall wait for redispatch time. That's the 17. So that's the red shading part is the 17. And since this is all on the QR, then QR mod delay, which is a subset of DISP wait for the time you spent waiting for redispatch on the QR, that is also 17. Okay? So let's go on to slide 38. And we're going to try to put all these pieces together. So I have them laid out there. There's the DISP 1 delay part of suspend time. And then there's the dispatch time part of suspend time. And then the last one is the non-DISP 1 delay suspend time. And so I've put them end to end here, showing the entire sort of average response time of those four transactions. And so I put the two sections of suspend time together, so as a whole you can see what the average suspend time is. You know, that comes to the 57 or 8 units, which is what's in my chart down below highlighted. Average suspend time is 58, a piece of which is the DISP 1 delay, of course. And then the dispatch time is laid out there as well. And the overall response time is 73. Okay, let's go on to slide 39, please. And I need to come clean a little bit on this DISP 1 delay. It's not all just waiting your turn to run on the QRTCB. It also includes any time queued for max task or T class. So actually, only that part of DISP 1 delay that's not ECL delay or max task delay, only that part is waiting for dispatch on the QRTCB. Okay? In our example, we had none of that T-class or max task delay. So let's go on to slide 40, and I'm going to read this moral of the story here. So QR mod delay plus DISP 1 delay minus ECL delay and max task delay is the amount of time tasks are waiting to be dispatched on the QR. When that is most of your suspend time, then what matters most, what is limiting throughput and increasing response times most, is QR DISP time. Okay, so, right, when most of your suspend time is waiting for redispatch on the QR, then you need to concentrate on, well, how long are tasks using the QRTCB? Because that's what's limiting your throughput in that case. And you'll see that's really the case in my examples with our lab that we did. Okay, let's go on to slide 41, please. All right. I'm going to read this to make sure I get it right. So average QR DISP time limits throughput in those cases when it's the limiter. Of course, you're not always necessarily bottlenecked on the QRTCB. It's often the case, though. So if each task needs 1 second of QR DISP time, then the CSS region can only sustain an arrival rate of 1 per second at best. So if you get 2 per second, then you're going to back up because each one needs 1 whole second of QR dispatch time in that sort of in that example, of course. Another way to think about this is with this formula. So 1 divided by average QR disk time is the maximum number of transactions per second that could be sustained without backing up towards max task. So like in our case, our average QR disk time is 15, 0.0015. So 1 divided by that is 667. So there's 667 tasks can each use 0.0015 of QR time and have that all fit within a second. Okay? All right, so let's carry on with slide 42. And we're going to shift gears a little bit and use these same forms, but we're going to use the data from our recreate of that max task situation. So let's carry on with slide 43. And here we go. I want to point out that these intervals are 30-second intervals. So if you look at the start interval column on the far left, you can see that they're 30 seconds apart. So each line then summarizes, averages, or totals all the transactions that started during that interval. And the next column over is that number of tasks that started during that interval. All right, so our max task situation began after 7:10:00. And so you can see that reflected in the average response time column. So right about 7:09:30, really, you can see it starting to bump up. And then clearly at 7:10 and several intervals after, the average response time is way higher than what it was normally. And so that's our problem. We're trying to understand what changed to make it during those 3 minutes, what made it go higher. And then you can see highlighted over as well, I have the average max task delay column highlighted. And there you can see that in the first intervals and the last intervals, there is no max task delay. So you know from that you weren't at max task. You, of course, also know from those messages when more precisely you went to max task and everything. So that's a good way, if you're just looking at KICS-PA data, to see, well, was anything queued for max task during these times? And you can tell that way. Okay, let's go to slide 44. And kind of more of the same. I just want to point out here to say again that a transaction is always, it's either dispatched or it's suspended. And so you'll find that those add up. The average dispatch plus the average suspend equals the average response. All right, let's go to slide 45, please. Okay, so when you're working on one of these problems, it's key to understand what's normal. Like when I'm working on these problems with you folks, I don't know what's normal at all. So I'll need to do something like this to see what's normal. So I see what's normal here for dispatch time, you know, about 9 milliseconds. I think I start to call it here coming up. So about 9 milliseconds of dispatch time, a whole bunch of suspend time, and that's normal. And then in the problem interval, that bumps up. The dispatch time bumps up a lot, and the suspend time does as well. Okay, so let's continue on to slide 46. All right, so now we're going to graph the same way we did that sample data. We're going to graph this stuff. And so we'll start with the portion of suspend time that is waiting for first dispatch. And this is on one of those normal intervals. This is 7:08:30. This is before the problem started. So I had 60 milliseconds of average disk one delay time, so I've indicated that there. And then you see there's no max task or T-class delay. So all 60 of those milliseconds of wait for first dispatch time is really waiting to be dispatched on the QRTCB. None of it was queued for max task or T-class delay. Okay, let's go on to 547. All right, now this is the rest of suspend time, the part that's not wait for first dispatch. And so my total suspend time, from the sus sum form, I can see it was 102 milliseconds. So that total red bar is 102. And then at 60, of course, is the dividing line for wait for first dispatch. And of that rest of suspend time, almost all of that was waiting for dispatch on the QR. So it's almost all shaded in red. So clearly from that, you know that the reason, response time is what it is limited by the QRTCB. That's the bottleneck on this region during this workload, and that's the norm. This again is during a normal interval. All right, let's go on to slide 48, please. All right, and then the last piece of response time is the dispatch piece, And so up above you see, oh, I don't have it highlighted. On the disk sum form, you have average QR disk is 9 milliseconds, and average QR CPU is about 9 milliseconds as well. And so that's why there's that 9-unit-long green bar tacked on the end. So even though the if you take the response time as a whole, you can see that you know, most of it wasn't, you know, dispatched on the QRTCB. That's still the most important part, since the whole suspend time is waiting its turn to use the QRTCB. Then the key thing to keep in mind is the time each transaction used the QRTCB. The fact that it's 9 milliseconds limits how much how many transactions per second can run. Okay, and again, this is the normal interval. Okay, so let's go on to slide 49 and take a look at some of these dispatch time measurements on the disk sum form. And I'm just pointing out here how that average dispatch time, you can see it it bumps up for some reason in that 7-10 interval. And that's going to become our focus. It's clear now that that's why suspend times increased. It's because these transactions started using more dispatch time. Okay, so let's go on to slide 50. All right, now this is a neat kind of way to do that formula I gave you. You know, 1 divided by the average QR dispatch time. Well, you don't even really have to think about that formula so much. So in this form, the intervals are 30 seconds long. And so by that total QR disk time, it kind of totals it up for you. And you can see easily that, say, in that first interval, the 29.6. So for the transactions that ran in those 30 seconds, they were using the QRTCB 29.6 of those. You can tell easily and at a glance that you're at your limit when you use this total column. And anyway, so that all fits. That's the limiting factor. Both in the problem intervals and in the normal intervals for this particular workload. And that fits with how all the transaction suspend time is waiting for redispatch. Okay, let's go to slide 51. Okay, and I just want to ask this question here. How is it possible for tasks that ran in a 30-second interval to use more than 30 seconds of QR disk time? And, you know, it's not really possible. The reason it works out this way is that the start interval here is showing all the transactions that started during those 30 seconds. Some transactions, no doubt, started right at the very tail end at 7:10:29.9. So they're therefore included in that interval. But all of their processing, you know, was in the next interval. And that's how, because you can see the average response time for that interval is 2.1, so those transactions could have been doing their work, 2 seconds into the next interval, but they're all included in the interval in which they started. So that's why that looks a little bit crazy. Okay, let's go to slide 52. Okay, so this is key. Like I've said, how average QR dispatch time suddenly increases. I want you to notice the average QR CPU time. Remember, so the CPU time is the time you're actually executing instructions using a processor, and the disk time is more the time you're in control of the QRTCB. And that ratio is really very important and very telling. Often on problems like these, you'll find that the average CPU time, the average QR CPU time remains the same, but what changes is the average QR dispatch time. So that ratio becomes worse. Like if it's a 1-to-1 ratio, you know, that's great. And then all of a sudden it changes to a 1-to-2 ratio. And so your dispatch time increases a bunch, even though you're using the same CPU. That's a frequent problem that causes response times to balloon momentarily while that ratio, that QR CPU to dispatch ratio has gotten smaller. Here, that's not the case, though. That ratio is very, very similar here during the problem period. Things actually started using more CPU, not just dispatch time. So that's a little bit of a unique quality about this recreate, although I certainly have have seen that before in customer data where you have your transactions and they have a sort of a normal amount of CPU they use, and then suddenly maybe around noontime or in the early afternoon it just uses more. And we'll talk about a reason for that. It's key in this recreate. So let's go on to slide 53, please. And here I'm just showing how I have reduced that interval now from 30 seconds down to 1 second. So these are 1 second intervals now, so we can see more precisely the exact point where the problem began. And you see it actually begins right about 7:09:58, where that average QR CPU time and average dispatch time jumps up for some reason. And when it jumps up, average response time starts to jump up as well. Okay, so let's go to slide 54 and see what's there. Oh, yes. Okay, so sums it up. I'm going to read this. Prior to 7:09:58, there was a balance between transaction arrival rate and QR dispatch time. Just enough transactions were arriving to keep the QR TCB totally busy. But then the about 33% increase in QR dispatch time and QR CPU time breaks that balance. Now transactions are arriving faster than they can get their QR TCB time, and so they back up. So that's the cause of this one. Let's go to slide 55. And we're going to continue to try to figure out, if we can, look for clues about what happened around 7:09:58 that might have caused this increase in CPU.
And continuing on now, the new technique that we've tried is this RMF3 data. RMF3 tells us how much CPU is being used and what jobs are using it. And again, the problem, we see that transactions in IYNXK suddenly starting to use significantly more CPU at around about 7:09:58. Slide 56, please. So here's the primary RMF monitor menu screen, where basically we're interested in the job delays, so you need to hit selection 2. Slide 57. Here is another screen, and this is broken down that now you can specify the desired job report, and in this case we're interested in IYNXK, and continuing we need the jobs again, so this will be selection 5 now. Slide 58, please. So on here you need to take note the time. Now this time value is before the problem started occurring, but also that there's a range of about 100 seconds. And a way to navigate through this data is by either PF10 or PF11, which goes backwards and forwards. Slide 59, please. Now, another form of navigation would be that you could also just manually type in the time frame that you're interested in, but when you're doing this, you need to ensure that the range value is still the same or the value that you specified or desire. Slide 60, please. So, again, this is the value prior to the problem, or the time frame before the problem. We see that IYNXK is using about 91% and has a delay for about 9%. And then the job of IYNXJ is roughly around 9% usage as well. Slide 61, please. This is the time interval when the problem started occurring. And we see that IYNXK looks to be about the same, no real major change except for maybe the delay is a little bit, percentage-wise, a little bit different. Now, the biggest difference, of course, is that IYNXJ is now using about 91%, and that's a lot more than what the prior interval was. So let's take a little deeper look at that CPU usage on slide 62, please. This is back to the main RMF data menu screen. And this time we will be using selection 3 of resource. Slide 63, please. And continuing, we need further down processor usage of 1 able. Slide 64. Note the value of the time again, that this is prior to the problem, and that we see that IYNXJ is using about 94%. And that K was 94, and then IYNXJ is about 3%. And in order, we're going to navigate to get to that next time. of when the problem occurred, and that will be on slide 65. So here we see that now IYNXJ is using about 91%, and then IYNXK is still using roughly about the same amount as well. So are all these transactions, the new consumption of IYNXJ causing transactions in IYNXK to use more CPU? Let's see if we can explain that.
Hey, I just want to add one thing, that neither Nick nor I are, experts in RMF3, and no doubt probably most of you fit in that category as well. But it's not necessary. We're just showing you a couple of areas where you can go hunting. We're just looking for clues to what happened on IYNXK. And so, like when we started, we went to that job thing. That was all from IYNXK's perspective. And if you just compare the time when things are normal to the time when things are not normal and kind of see what's different, you're just looking for clues. And that clue, even though we weren't looking for IYNXJ, it popped up there on that screen, and it gave us a little clue on what was different that was big. So that's all. Slide 66, please.
So the next method that we used was this new sys-trace perf data. In regards, it's fairly similar to the RMF in regards to that it also uses CPUs being used and what jobs are using it. This is a new and newly documented command that's been offered at ZOS 112 and above. We're going to be continuing on with the scenario of a good and bad, and we're going to use the slip dump that we've recently captured with these new messages, the specification messages that we've captured of the above 80, and then also we took a dump while the region was looking good for a normal workload. Slide 67. And here's the IPS sub screen, and basically you just need to add in or type in this sys-trace perf data as it is. Slide 68. So here, this format, so sys-trace perf data processes the system trace, and we can see that for the system trace we have two processors, and both of them are taking up about 9 seconds of trace time from about range of 6.10.14 to 6.10.14.9. Slide 69, please. One thing to take note of is this idle time is zero, which means that both processors are completely busy during this time frame, and neither one had a moment of no work to do. So in order to see what jobs are using the CPU time, we need to scroll down. In this case, slide 70, please. So from here, we can see that IYNXJ and IYNXK are using about that 1.8 seconds. So they're the ones that are using most of that processor. Now let's have a look at the normal dump. Slide 71, please. Again, similar results, but this time we're seeing that two processors again, but this time they're covering a time frame of about 1.7 seconds, and we see there are a lot of idle time than we had in the prior slides. We're going to look at now at the jobs again on slide 72. So we can see here that it's basically IYNXK is pretty much using about one processor's worth of CPU. And we see, as you can see from underneath the highlighted one, the IYNXJ is really not using much, and this is about normal from what we saw from the RMF data. So now comparing this with the RMF3 data, we see that during the problem, IYNXJ and IYNXK are using most of the processors. But before and after the problem, K is the one using about 1% or one processor, and the other processors are pretty much in idle time. Slide 73, please.
Okay, so we've learned a lot, but can we really answer the question? Can what we've learned really cause that 33% more CPU? So clues point to IYNXJ. So let's use the SMF110 data from it to see how that squares with when the problem began. So that's on slide 74. And this is that DIP-SUM form summarizing transactions on each second. And indeed, right at 709.58 is where some transactions soak come in. And as you can see on the right, the highlighted section, that total L8 CPU time, so these transactions are using pretty much a whole processor, like 0.9 seconds of total L8 CPU time for transactions that came in during a second. Okay, so that's the process. That's what's going on in J. And it's these soak transactions, when they started up, then the transactions in K started using more CPU. Okay, let's go to slide 75. And this is what that soak transaction is doing. So I have several of these going at once, and they're all doing execx get main freeman over and over. And each get main is 20 meg of EDSA, and the get main specifies in an image. And so that causes CSS to touch, like with 40s, or whatever the init image value is, touch every single page in that 20 meg. So you do a get main 20 meg, touch it, and Kix has to touch every page, and then you free it, and then you get main again, and Kix has to touch every page. And so that's going on and on. And this gets into how it can affect totally different transactions running in a different Kix region. And it has to do with high-speed cache in the computer, in the box. So when an LPAR is like 50% busy, so your transaction's running along and populating the high-speed cache, as you access pages, control blocks or file buffers, the things that your application does and the things that CSS itself needs to do on behalf of your application, you tend to access certain pages of storage, and that those pages get populated into the high-speed cache, and instructions are faster when their storage accesses are all satisfied from within the high-speed cache than is the case if it's outside in regular memory. So things are faster like that. When you lose control, when your TCB loses control of the processor, somebody else is using the processor, and somebody else is populating the high-speed cache with things that they need. And in the case of these soak transactions, it's populating it with pages and pages and pages of storage having to do with these 20-meg get mains. So very, very frequently, every time when our transactions in K, they get interrupted, when they get going again, their instructions are slower for a time because all of their data references have to be satisfied from outside of the high-speed cache. And so because of this, a path length of instructions can literally, it does use more CPU. It takes more CPU time to execute the same path length of instructions when, say, the LPAR is extremely busy as compared to when the LPAR is not busy. So there's definitely a growth in how much CPU it takes to execute a certain path length of instructions, depending on what's going on in the LPAR. And that's what caused ours, is those soak transactions and the way they, one, made the LPAR be 100% busy, and two, the way they totally monopolized the high-speed cache with the way it was doing those get mains. Okay, let's go on to slide 76, please. So just a quick summary. So what did we do today? We learned about a neat new tool to put out console messages as a way to expose when you're at max task or getting close to max task. We learned a way to get a dump on those messages with a slip. You got a quick Kix dispatcher refresher. We talked about a way to approach response time spikes using SMF110 data. We got a taste of how to use RMS3 to solve some of these problems, to give you some insight and some clues about what's going on in your Kix regions, and a very similar tool with a dump, the IPCS tool, SysTrace PerfData, another way to get an LPAR's perspective, even if it's a dump just of a Kix region. And then we talked about an interesting reason why average CPU per transaction may vary from moment to moment. Okay, so let's go into slide 77, please. And there's the familiar list of additional websites for some additional WebSphere product resources for your convenience. And then, so, David, I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks, Dan and Nick, for a great presentation. Don't forget to connect with us. Be notified about upcoming webcasts related to the product and topics discussed today by subscribing to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange mailing list. Simply send an email to wsehelp@us.ibm.com with the subject of WSTE Subscribe to get a list of mailing lists and to subscribe. Also, if there's a topic that you'd like to see scheduled or if you have any comments that would help us improve our future webcasts, please let us know at that same email address. You could also connect with us through our Facebook page and our Twitter account. Talk to us and let us know how we can make this program even better for you. We welcome any ideas that you may have. Thanks again for your participation. At this point, Jackie, we'd like to open the lines for questions.
One moment, please, for your first question. Mike Giaquinto, your line is open.
Hi, Dan and Nick. Thanks very much. It was pretty informative. I have a couple of questions. One back on slide 9, you chose async versus sync. And my question is, how fast does the, after the emit of the event, does the slip dump get taken? And would sync have an effect on that? Would we see, and where I'm going with this is if we were to perhaps emit an event based on a content of a comm area, would that event be, would we get a dump immediately right there at the link, for instance? Or would it be seconds later or milliseconds later after the task is dispatched?
Yes. Well, for system events, you can't do sync. It has to be async. And so there is a little delay because that's why for the transaction definition for this, for the transaction definition, when you choose the user custom user program adapter, that's why I made it 255. And as well, there's some event processing, you know, there's a whole TCB for the event processing, and that dispatch priority of high plays into that. So on a system event, you can't do any better than saying dispatch priority high and making your transaction for that custom adapter be priority 255. There is a delay. Now, are you talking about probably not a system event, but more of an application event?
Right. Yeah. I was actually talking to Catherine Moxie about this, and what she was looking for is what uses of events would I see, and one of them was just like you're saying here. You know, it would be great to be able to look at an event as an opportunity to take an application style dump. We're shooting a problem. It's only when this record contains this data or this comm area contains that data, and we want to, at that point, stop and say, let's get a dump.
Right. I haven't tested recently enough if it's totally – with system events, it has to be asynchronous. But for an application event, can you specify synchronous and have the action, say a custom program that puts out a message, have it be totally synchronous with the application? The application has not moved on at the point when the event is emitted and the message is put out. I'm pretty sure that you can, but I would have to be totally sure. I would have to work on it a little bit. Would you like me to do that? I will, Mike.
We can work on it too. We haven't yet. I mean, it's interesting if you could. That'd be great. But
okay, we'll do.
Because I think it's something that might be useful just for plain debugging, just when there's a problem.
Okay. Yes, I agree.
Great. All right. Thanks.
You're welcome.
We have no further questions.
Okay. Thank you, Jackie. Dan and Nick, we do have a couple questions in the group chat. Are you able to see them, or do you want me to read them to you?
We need you to read them to us, please.
Okay. We have a question from Mahesh asking how to improve Kix CTG response time while invoking Kix from WebSphere process server using WebSphere Kix adapter. And moreover, he's looking to tune Kix connection factories on WPS.
I see. Well, I don't have an answer to that one. You know, certainly there's general, while the stuff is in CICS, while the transactions are in CICS and doing stuff, those transactions could be held up for the very reasons we've been talking about. So you know, techniques like we talked about today are still usable. But in terms of something sort of specific to that, I'm not aware of a presentation or a pitch that sort of specifically speaks to that. I will ask around and see if I can find an appropriate sort of a first place to go to help improve with those kinds of workloads. So I've got Mahesh's email, and I'll follow up with him on that as well.
Okay, thank you. Second question, it's actually a few, from Kevin Evans. He's talking about slide 43 shows 30-second intervals, generates large SMF files. We run 15-minute intervals and roll up into a PAHDB. How much overhead generated by using 30-second intervals?
Oh, yes, these 30-second intervals, it's all just reporting intervals. So with this same data, I could choose to summarize it at 15 minutes or 30 seconds. It has nothing to do with the rate that the SMF information was written out. Read that question for me again, David, please. I want to make sure I got it.
Okay. Slide 43 shows 30-second intervals, generates large SMF files. We run 15-minute intervals and roll up into a PAHDB. How much overhead is generated by using 30-second intervals?
Oh, I see. Yeah. So I think I understand that from the SMF level, you guys fill up your man X or man Y, and then every 15 minutes you'll switch and offload that 15 minutes worth of SMF data. Yeah. So right. So there'd be no difference. You don't have to do anything different in order to display the data on 30-second intervals. It's a total different thing. Okay, is there another one?
Yes, from Kevin. His second question is, slide 53 then shows 1-second intervals. How? I think he's asking, you know, why we went from 15-minute intervals to 1-second intervals.
Right. Here, let's go back to something like slide 20-something. That has to do with a KIXPA thing. So if on slide, I'm trying to see where it is, where I introduced those forms. So that's slide 32. So in there, you specify what you want the averages and summaries to be on. 30 seconds is the way that is given there. And you could just say 1 second, and it would be 1 second.
Okay. And Kevin is saying that he thinks that's already answered on slide 53.
Okay.
And then another question from Kevin is, we monitor the KIXPLEX with custom code using EMASIC and EMASWELL events, et cetera. We do currently have logic in there that detects MXT and outputs a list of the current running tasks. Is there a CPSM event that detects percent towards MXT with adjustable values? We are using KIX version 4.1, Explorer V110, PA V3.2, along with the Explorer PA plugin.
Right.
If this is getting real detailed, you might want to take it offline via email.
Okay.
That's up to you.
Yeah, I'll just quickly say, so a difference between what we did here with the system events and what you can do with CPSM is, and lots of monitors, with CPSM and lots of ones, you have to say how often you want to check. Like you have to tell CPSM how often do you want us to see if we're at max task or not. Do you want us to check every 10 seconds to see if we're at max task, or you know, you have to kind of poll. You have to sort of spend all day long constantly checking, am I at max task or not. The KIX system events, you don't have to do that. CSCS makes an event happen automatically when you reach some threshold or whatever. There's no polling involved. But for the rest of your question about is there a way within CPSM to do what you asked, that I'm not positive about, and I'll get back with you. That was a David. I'll have all the emails of all the questions later, so I can follow up on that one as well.
Okay. Thank you. And Kevin, again, is asking, is there a document that discusses the KIX events?
Yeah. I mean, other than the Information Center, I'm sure, yes, there is, yes, either a Red Book or perhaps a share presentation. I'll find a couple of good ones and email those.
Okay. Thank you. I believe that's all the questions. And so at this time, we'll conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Dan and Nick, for presenting.
You're welcome.
Welcome.
Bye, everybody.